Now, brethren, we'll have the privilege of having the second portion of blessing from our brother Dan Slavinsky. And he has chosen as his subject for this afternoon, "The Temple Will Save Us." The Temple Will Save Us. Brother Dan.
Thank you, Brother George. This afternoon, we will be looking into the subject of Israel's temple and glean some lessons for our own instructions. Some in Israel thought that they were safe and secure from any wrongdoing as long as Israel still had the temple. For they thought the temple will save us, for this is God's house, the divinely sanctioned place for worship. Israel's first place of worship was the tabernacle. We recall that the tabernacle was set up by Moses a year after their exodus from Egypt, and the tabernacle continued to be the place of worship for Israel after they entered into the promised land. The tabernacle continued through the period of the judges and was replaced by the temple during King Solomon's reign. Solomon's temple was destroyed in 606 BC by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. And 70 years later, after the decree of the Persian king Cyrus, the Jews began to rebuild the temple known as Zerubbabel's temple, because Zerubbabel was the Jewish governor at the time. Zerubbabel's temple was subsequently plundered and then fell into disrepair, then rebuilt and enlarged by King Herod in the time of Jesus. It was known as Herod's temple. Herod's temple was destroyed by the Romans and 70 A.D. Now let us consider Solomon's temple during the time period of the prophet Jeremiah. Turn with me to Jeremiah, the 7th chapter. Jeremiah 7. When Jeremiah came on the scene, the 10-tribe kingdom had already been overthrown and taken captive by the Syrians. Benjamin and Judah became the two-tribe kingdom known as the Kingdom of Judah. Jeremiah's ministry extended over the last 40 years of the Kingdom of Judah to the destruction of Jerusalem and the deportation of the people to Babylon. Jeremiah was known as a prophet of doom because he served during the declining years of the Kingdom of Judah, when his message was that their kingdom would be destroyed by Babylon. He prophesied during the reign of King Josiah and his sons Jehoiakim and Zedekiah. Now in Jeremiah, the 7th chapter, verse 1, it says, "The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, stand in the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim there this word and say, hear the word of the Lord, all ye of Judah that enter in at these gates to worship the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place." And then in verse 4 it says, "Trust ye not in lying words, saying, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these," and the thought is, are these buildings that you see. The Lord's house, mentioned in verse 2, refers to the temple that King Solomon had built. And the people did not like Jeremiah's words because he told the truth. They preferred prophets and counselors who would tell them what they wanted to hear, even though it was lying words. Lying prophets said, "The temple of the Lord. The temple will save us. God will protect Jerusalem because His temple is here. This is the temple. The people of Judah thought they were safe and secure from Nebuchadnezzar as long as they had the temple, because that was God's dwelling place. It was the authorized place of worship. In it was the Ark of the Covenant, where a supernatural light appeared, shining out between the cherubim, representing the divine presence. Jeremiah told the kingdom of Judah to amend their ways. What was Judah doing wrong to receive this rebuke from Jeremiah? In verse 5, we read, "For if ye thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if ye thoroughly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if ye oppress not the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, and shed not innocent blood in this place, neither walk after other gods to your hurt, then I will cause you to dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever." The covenant that God made with Israel had blessings and curses attached to it. Blessings if they were faithful in attempting to keep the law, and calamities and punishments if they were neglectful. And then Jeremiah continues with his rebuke in verses 8 through 11. He says, "Behold, ye trust in lying words that cannot profit. Will ye steal, murder, and commit adultery, and swear falsely, and burn incense unto Baal, and walk after other gods whom ye know not, and come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered to do all these abominations? Is this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, even I have seen it, saith the Lord." In other words, the Lord was saying, "I see all your abominations. You think you can be cleared by any wrongdoing by just coming to the temple for worship?" Jeremiah was warning Israel, Judah, against presuming that they were in God's favor because of their outward ceremonies and sacrifices performed in the temple. Then in verse 12 of chapter 7, the Lord calls to their mind something that came before the temple. In verse 12, he says, "But go ye now unto my place, which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of the people Israel, of my people Israel." Jeremiah is saying to them, because of your wickedness, if you think nothing will happen to you because you still have the temple, think again about Shiloh. Well, what about Shiloh? What happened there? We recall it was Joshua who led Israel into the promised land by crossing the Jordan. The Jordan overflowed its banks at that time of year in the spring, and the waters of the Jordan were parted as a priest carried the Ark of the Covenant into the river. And then all the people passed over. And Israel then, led by Joshua, they conquered Jericho by taking the Ark and carrying it around the city, and the walls came down. Then Joshua went on to conquer the land and gave the various tribes their inheritance. Finally, we read in where the Ark found a resting place. This is in Joshua 18:1. Joshua 18:1, and it reads, "And the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh and set up the tabernacle of the congregation there, and the land was subdued before them." Now, Shiloh is located about 25 miles north of Jerusalem. It was a good location to set up the tabernacle from the viewpoint of a central location. and it remained there during the period of the judges for many years. And the Ark of the Covenant was captured by the Philistines during the ministry of Eli, the high priest. And we read about how this came about in 1 Samuel, 1 Samuel, the second chapter. 1 Samuel, second chapter, verse 12, it reads, "The sons of Eli were sons of Belial." In the Hebrew, Belial means worthless and evil. "The sons of Eli were sons of Belial. They knew not the Lord." And in verses 13 through 16, it describes the people, by divine direction, they're coming to the tabernacle to offer sacrifices. And Eli's sons, they misuse their position as priests, under priests, by taking more of the offerings for themselves than they were properly allowed by the divine arrangement. Besides this, they practice immorality and they misled the people into unrighteousness. As the Lord's servants and priests, they should have been instructors of the people in righteousness, both by precept and example. And then in verse 17 of 1 Samuel, the second chapter, we read, "Wherefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for men despise the offering of the Lord." And then in verse 27, we read, "There came a man of God unto Eli," a prophet, "and he said unto him, Thus saith the Lord, Did I plainly appear unto the house of thy father when they were in Egypt in Pharaoh's house? And did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest and to offer upon mine altar, to burn incense, to wear an ephod before me? And did I give unto the house of thy father all the offerings made by fire of the children of Israel? Wherefore kick ye at my sacrifice and at mine offering, which I had commanded in my habitation, and honors thy sons above me, to make yourself fat with the choice part of all the offerings of the people of Israel? Them that honor me, I will honor, and they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed." And then we go to verse 34 of the second chapter. It says, the prophet said, "And this shall be a sign unto thee, that shall come upon thy two sons, on Hophni and Phinehas. In one day they shall die, both of them. And I will raise me up a faithful priest that shall do according to that which is in mine heart and in my mind." Now, this was not the first time that the Lord had reproved Eli regarding the wrong course of his sons and what would happen. Now, shortly after this, the Philistines came against Israel in battle, and the Israelites, they lost 4,000 men in one day. When the Israelites turned back to their camp, they inquired, why did we lose this battle? And in 1 Samuel, the fourth chapter now, 1 Samuel 4, verse 3, we read, "And when the people were come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us today before the Philistines?" And then the elders came up with a proposal, something which worked in the past. They said, continuing in verse 3, "Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies." The Israelites had remembered the promises made to their fathers concerning the Ark of the Covenant. We read in Numbers 10:35, "And it came to pass, when the Ark set forward, that Moses said, Rise up, Lord, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let them that hate thee flee before thee. And Israel also remembered how the ark parted the waters of Jordan when they crossed into Canaan, and how it caused the walls of Jericho to come down. Israel thought that the ark would save them now. So it was determined to bring the ark of the Lord into this battle with the Philistines. They thought, the ark will save us. That is the same thought which is brought out by Jeremiah 7:4, when lying prophet said, the temple of the Lord will save us. Now we read in verse 4 of 1 Samuel 4, so the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring forth from thence the ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth between the cherubims, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the ark of the covenant of God. So here comes the ark with the two priests into battle. They are the representatives of God's holiness, but they don't represent God. Hophni and Phinehas were thieves and robbers, immoral people. Therefore, God's blessing was not to be expected under such conditions. And in verse 5, we read, and when the ark of the covenant of the Lord came unto the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, what meaneth the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews? And they understood that the ark of the Lord was coming to the camp. And the Philistines were afraid, for they said, God is coming to the camp. And they said, woe unto us, for such a thing has not happened before. Woe unto us, who shall be able to deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. Be strong and quit yourselves like men, O ye Philistines, that ye be not servants unto the Hebrews as they have been to you. Quit yourselves like men and fight. In other words, let's take courage and fight like men. And in verse 10 it says, and the Philistines fought, and Israel was smitten. And they fled every man unto his tent. And there was a very great slaughter, for there fell of Israel 30,000 footmen. And the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were slain. And there ran a man of Benjamin out of the camp and came to Shiloh that same day. And we read in verse 15, now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were dim that he could not see. And the man said unto Eli, I am he that came out of the army, and I fled today out of the army. And he said, what is done, my son? What is there done, my son? And the messenger answered and said, Israel is fled before the Philistines, and there hath been also a great slaughter among the people, and thy two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God is taken. And it came to pass, when he had made mention of the ark of God, that he fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck broke, and he died, for he was an old man and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. Now we can see by Eli's death how the loss of the ark was more tragic than the loss of his sons. It was when he heard of the ark's capture that Eli fell from off his seat. So bringing the Ark of the Covenant into battle with the Philistines did not save them. The battle was lost. 30,000 men died, also the high priest and his sons, and the Ark was captured. Now this battle took place at Ebenezer, about 20 miles from Shiloh. However, Shiloh itself was most likely overrun and destroyed by the Philistines at that time, or possibly at a later date. And the destruction of Shiloh is referred to in Psalm 78, Psalm 78, verse 60, where we read, "So that he," that is God, because of Israel's sins, "so that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he had placed among men, and delivered his strength into captivity and his glory unto the enemy's hand. He gave his people over also unto the sword. He was wroth with his inheritance. The fire consumed the young men, and their maidens were not given to marriage. Their priests fell by the sword, and their widows made no lamentation." So we see that Shiloh was permitted to be destroyed. As Jeremiah pointed out almost 500 years after his destruction in Jeremiah 7:12, "Go ye now unto the place which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel." Now we can see for ourselves today what the Lord did at Shiloh. You know, in 1992, we had the opportunity to visit Shiloh along with other brethren, and we visited the wall and the gate and the entrance to this ancient city, and the city is destroyed. And recent digs at that time revealed a foundation of a building where they found 9 clay jugs. Each one was about 3 feet high, and about 80 other large jugs were found there. And our guide said this was probably the storehouse for the tabernacle supplies, maybe of the olive oil. Now, returning to the defeat of Israel when the ark was captured, what happened to the ark of the covenant that day? The Philistines took it to Ashdod and set it next to their image of their god Dagon. The next day, the statue Dagon had fallen on his face before the ark. The Philistines set him upright again, but the next day they found Dagon on the floor again with his head and his hands broken off. The Philistines at Ashdod and other territories around there, they begin to break out in hemorrhoids, and the land was overrun with mice. And finally, in despair, after 7 months, the Philistines sent the ark back to Israel. They put it on a cart pulled by 2 cows. It remained in Israel for 70 years through the ministry of Samuel, who judged Israel for 20 years, and through the reign of King Saul for 40 years. Finally, when David was anointed king over all Israel, after he reigned in Hebron for 7 years, he brought the ark to Jerusalem, the city of David. The ark had been kept in the house of Abinadab at the time, and Israel put it on a new cart pulled by a pair of oxen. Abinadab's sons were in charge of the transportation of this ark. And one son, Uzzah, he reached up to steady the ark, and he was struck dead. King David had neglected to look into the law concerning the ark and how it should be transported and who should touch it. It was to be carried by the Levites, using a pole on either side of the ark, bearing the weight on their shoulders. It was quite a lesson in reverence for all the Israelites concerning the laws of God. 3 months later, they tried again, carried by the Levites correctly. It finally arrived in Jerusalem, and it was placed in a tent that King David had provided. Now, later on, David told Nathan the prophet, "I live in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwelleth within curtains." David wanted to build a permanent place for the ark, but he was told by God he could not build this temple, but his son Solomon would. David, however, was able to make preparation for it. King Solomon finally built the temple, and the priests brought the Ark of the Covenant out of the city of Zion to the temple located on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. It was placed in the most holy section in the temple. Now, having seen how the ark, after being captured, found a resting place in the temple, we will return to Jeremiah's day some 400 years later, to the time when Israel, through the advice of the false prophets, are saying, "The temple will save us. We have the presence of God. We have the ark." Jeremiah said, and it's recorded in 7:14, chapter 7, verse 14. He says, "Therefore will I do unto this house," that's the temple, "which is called by my name, wherein ye trust, and unto the place which I gave to you and to your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh." And Jeremiah's words came true. The temple was plundered and destroyed by the Babylonians, and the ark's whereabouts are unknown. It may have been taken away or destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. Cyrus, king of Persia, gave permission to the Hebrews after 70 years of captivity to go back to Israel, rebuild the city and the temple. This was beginning in 536 A.D. And under the leadership of Haggai the prophet, Zerubbabel, the governor of Judah, and Joshua the high priest, the temple was rebuilt. But no matter how great this accomplishment was, it was inferior to that of Solomon's. The prophet Haggai, in chapter 2, verse 3, Haggai 2, verse 3 says, "Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing?" One important thing that the temple lacked was the Ark of the Covenant. Now, some writers claim that the Ark had to be there, but the scriptures do not say so. Now, in later years, Zerubbabel's temple was again plundered and defiled. And we now come to the time of Jesus, and Herod the Great spent years rebuilding and enlarging and further beautifying Zerubbabel's temple. When Jesus said, "Destroy the temple and he could raise it up in 3 days," the Jews told Jesus that they had been building and renovating the temple for 46 years. Herod's temple stood on the same spot as Solomon's temple. But again, there is no mention of the ark in Herod's temple. Now, the nation of Israel at the time of Jesus was under Roman rule. And with proud hearts, they again thought, "The temple will save us. God is on our side." However, Jesus entered the temple at the close of his ministry and began to cast out them that sold and bought in the temple, overthrew the table of the money changers and seats of them that sold doves, and said, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called of all nations the house of prayer,' but ye have made it a den of thieves"? After the destruction of Shiloh, the destruction of Solomon's temple, and the plundering of Zerubbabel's temple, the Jews still had not learned their lesson. Corruption and greed continued. And finally Jesus said, "Behold, your house is left unto you desolate." So Jesus pronounced judgment against the Jewish, nominal Jewish house, and their literal temple was cleansed by him. Now the prophet Daniel, Daniel 9:26, says, "And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary." And the people of the prince was the Roman general Titus. His army destroyed the city of Jerusalem and the temple, and he left behind terrible waste and destruction. And this was in 6970 AD. Now we recall the nominal Jewish house is a type of the nominal Christian house. Jesus sowed good seed in the field, but after the apostles fell asleep in death, his enemies sowed tares in the field. And the apostle Paul, in writing on, this is 2 Thessalonians 2:3, he said, "There would come a falling away, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Paul said this system of error, mystery of iniquity, doth already work. The beginning started in his day. It continued to develop, and a religious ruler, the Pope, claiming authority over all other religious rulers, figuratively sat in the temple of God. Now, this temple was the false temple of God, the Antichrist system. As corruption, greed, and pride were factors in the Jewish temples, so the same with the nominal Christian temple. And then with the Reformation in process years later, this system of error developed many daughters, a mother and a daughter system. And each sect set up false, unscriptural standards and doctrines which have developed many tares and choked and separated the wheat. The doctrine of the ransom sacrifice for all and the two salvations were lost sight of. The claim of the false Christian temple has been, we are the true church. God will save us. The casting off of Jesus of the nominal Jewish house and the cleansing of the literal temple in 33 AD corresponds to the time parallel of 1878 in which the nominal Christian temple is rejected and cleansed by a return Lord. Babylon hath been a golden cup in the Lord's hand, but since 1878 the call is to come out of her, my people. It is the time of harvest and a time of separation. And the Lord will be the chief reaper and director of the work. There are two parts to the harvest, the gathering of the wheat, followed by the burning of the tares. We believe there is a difference between Babylon falling in a judicial sense and being rejected by the Lord and the actual destruction when she goes down like a millstone. Babylon's final destruction will be with violence, and she will not be heard of again anymore. It will be at Babylon's destruction that the tares who remain in Babylon will know for sure that they were not true Christians. They were deceived and were not of the true temple class. And we believe these final events of Babylon's complete destruction lie in the future for the Christian world. Now, there is a true temple class that has been developed throughout the gospel age. When Jesus said in John 2:19, destroy the temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up, he was referring to his body members. His church will reach its completion in the first resurrection. As living stones, we are now called to places in the glorious temple. We come to Jesus, who as the Father's representative, shapes, chisels, fits, and polishes us for places in the glorious temple of the future, the meeting place between God and the world. As in the typical temple built by Solomon, every stone was thoroughly fitted in the quarry and for its place in the building. And so with all the preparation that we see is done in this present life. Ephesians 2:19 states, now therefore ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building, fitly framed together, groweth unto a holy temple in the Lord, in whom ye also are builded together for a habitation of God through the Spirit. Now, in returning now to the words of the lying prophets of Israel, the temple will save us. God is on our side. Israel presumed that God would overlook their sinful living because of their temple. Can we, who are consecrated, the prospective true temple class, can we rely on something to save us? Do we have a symbolic temple to lean upon? In self-examination, and I speak this to myself, could it be a work we are doing? Could it be a segment of the Lord's people that we meet with? Could it be our ecclesia? Could it be our family or our spouse? Could it be the amount of witness work we are engaged in? Could it be the amount of brethren we have brought into the truth? David in the 19th Psalm, verse 13, he says, David prayed, "Keep back thy servant also from presumptuous sin. Let them not have dominion over me." Keep back thy servant also from presumptuous sin. What are presumptuous sins? To presume means to take for granted without authority or proof. This warning of presumptuous sins can also be applied to the consecrated class. We too could presume upon God's goodness through Christ's merit, becoming lax in correcting ourselves and assuming God will overlook any of our shortcomings or our faults without ourselves putting forth any effort. Or we may assume that we know what is best for ourselves and not fully submit to God's leading and direction. So, brethren, as we consider these lessons, especially the lessons of Israel's temple, the Apostle Paul, in writing to the church at Corinth, said, "Israel after the flesh was a type of spiritual Israel." And in 1 Corinthians 10:11, he said, "Now all these things happened unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come." And then he says in verse 12, "Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." May the Lord add his blessing.